Creeps Union. But the stakes had never been so high, not even close. This is a game changer, Siobhan and I had said to each other when the meeting got scheduled. I've never figured out if she knew what she was sending me into. She'd gone out of her way to mention Gavin was married and had daughters around my age. 18, then. Gavin was an inoffensive-looking, beigey, 50-ish guy with full, pale lips and wire-rimmed glasses and pocket squares that artfully complemented his ties. "I need to get a look at you," he said, and I decided to understand that as a professional need, not a personal one. I never told Siobhan because I didn't want her to know I'd actually done it. My uncle Mitch had been dead for a couple of months then, and even though he'd never exactly been involved or protective, I had a new, hard feeling of aloneness. I hadn't even hesitated. I'd stood there naked in front of Gavin, and I turned in a little circle when he asked me to. And when he took out his dick and asked me to please suck it, I did. The day after, Jones Cohen, I was lying by my pool watching a vulture circle. The sky in LA is full of vultures, sometimes great big spiraling tornadoes of them towering up into the clouds. Only people usually don't look. I was a little surprised, almost insulted, that there weren't any helicopters spying on me. Were the paparazzi allowed to use those little hobbyist drones? Maybe not, because they would if they could. That should be inscribed over their coat of arms. "We would if we could." The doorbell startled me. I thought the paps must have climbed my gate, decided to storm the house. It rang again. I waited for my assistant, Augustina, to deal with it until I remembered I'd sent her home, urgently pressing a packet of edibles into her hand, even though she doesn't like weed. My bodyguard, MG, was patrolling the perimeter. I heaved myself up, went and looked at the security screen. My neighbor, the venerable Sir Hugo Wolseley, "Venerable venal venereal," he says, was leaning close to the camera, waving a bottle of scotch and shouting, "Chicken soup for the philanderer's soul," into the intercom like he didn't trust it to actually transmit or amplify his voice. Hugo dresses like a hipster Nebuchadnezzar and lives with his young and beautiful boyfriend. So it always surprises me when he does old person stuff with technology. "Hey," I said, opening the door. "How'd you get past the gate?" "You gave Rudy the code ages ago. Don't you remember? He was making a little delivery." He mimed pulling on a joint. Hugo's boyfriend, Rudy's principal responsibilities in life were to keep it tight and to stay current on the best weed available citywide, medical or otherwise. "It's mayhem down there," he said, sweeping into the kitchen. "MG ought to have a bullwhip to crack at them." He was wearing huaraches and drawstring pants and blue and white ecot and an orange linen shirt unbuttoned to show a bear claw necklace nestled in his thick white chest hair. Hugo is tall and impressively burly for someone over 70 and has a sonorous, plummy voice and the world's most impressive stage pedigree. He poured us each a tumbler of scotch. "Chin chin," we clinked. "Rudy says the internet is burning. He says you set it on fire." "It deserved it," I said, following him into the largest of my living rooms. He sat on the couch and gestured me imperiously into one of my own chairs. "Oh, I agree." I raised my glass. "Thanks for this. It's really good." "Truly exceptional, you mean. And you're welcome. It wasn't like I was going to drink it with Rudy. It would be wasted on that palate. Might as well give it to a child. I wanted to be sure you were dulling your pain in style. I'm focusing more on opiates. Please don't have a meltdown. That would be dreadfully dull of you. And a terrible waste of talent, of course. I was kidding, I said. But obviously I'm already in the middle of a meltdown. No, no, no. Jones was the meltdown. Now you're rebounding. It's been, I calculated, 39 hours. This, my dear, is a golden opportunity to, I hate the word, but in this case it's apt, reinvent yourself. If you can't see how you might seize this particular moment, then you have no imagination at all, and I am extremely disappointed in you. I don't really see how to capitalize on everyone hating me. The crazy bitches had tweeted at me that I was a slut, a whore, a cunt. I deserved to die, they said, to be alone forever, to rot in hell. Thank God Oliver was free of me, they said. Men jumped in to tell me I was ugly and unfuckable, but also that I deserved to be raped, that I was going to choke to death on their dicks. They didn't even care about Archangel. They just couldn't pass up an opportunity to tell a woman that, A, they'd never fuck her, and also, B, they were going to fuck her until she died. I'd scrolled. I was hanging in the stocks so the village could come by and jeer at me. I had committed an act of terrorism, as far as the crazy bitches were concerned. I had attacked their way of life. The bitches said, in all caps, that they wanted me to suffer, to be obliterated. But really, they wanted me to fix it, to undo what I'd done, to return them to the way they were before. Every once in a while, someone would be like, hey, stay strong, girl. And that was enough to make me tear up. Then someone else would say, it was my fault Mitch had overdosed, or that my parents were lucky they were dead so they wouldn't have to be ashamed of me. Not everyone hates you, Hugo said. Just the, what do you call them? The crazy bitches. Most people don't care at all about Archangel, and therefore don't care at all about you. Don't look like that. It's a good thing. The worthwhile people probably think you just got more interesting, showed a little backbone. Not that Oliver isn't a nice boy, a gorgeous boy, but he's too vacuous for you. Of course I understand the appeal of the beautiful vacuous boy. Rudy isn't what you would call complicated. But, you know, I'm old. I want someone young and frivolous, whose most profound and complicated desire is for fun. Specifically, fun that is purchasable with money. That's an important distinction. Do you know how few people can actually be made genuinely happy by money? It's really quite rare. Rudy is what suits me now. But when I was your age, I wanted something fraught and epic that could... He bared his teeth and mimed ripping something in half. Tear me apart. His famous voice echoed off the ceiling. I wanted to tell him about Alexei, but Hugo gossips. I said, I haven't heard a peep from Oliver. He hasn't called to scream at me or anything. Just silence. My agent says his agent says he's devastated. But he cheated on me with at least one actress and at least one model and God knows who else. And I got over it. This whole heartbroken act is a bit much. He waved a hand in dismissal, then leveled his most piercing gaze at me and asked, what drew you to Oliver in the first place? Have you seen Oliver? Hugo pierced harder. I said, he was the only one who understood what it was like to live through the whole Archangel thing. You know how people say you should choose someone you'd want to be in a foxhole with? But this was like, what if you're in a foxhole already, and someone else happens to be in there too? Then you have the foxhole in common, which is not nothing. I drained my glass. Hugo went to the kitchen and came back with the bottle. And then, he said, pouring, did the foxhole lose its luster? He became part of the claustrophobia. Hugo draped one arm elegantly along the back of the sofa, his drink dangling from his fingertips. Forget love. My dear, I'm a self-absorbed old narcissist, not your nanny. So I don't care all that much what you do. Mostly I'm here because I can't resist meddling. But as someone who's made many rather impressive messes over the years, if I do say so myself, I believe I am uniquely well qualified to advise. This is different. I beg your pardon. How so? You're a man, for starters. And there wasn't an internet when you were being chaotic. You're right. It's been a very simple thing being me, he glowered. I almost married a woman once. A woman! Disgusting. Let me ask you, what is the worst possible outcome of all this? Endless public shaming? I get fired from Archangel and never work again. It wouldn't be endless. People will move on sooner than you think. They don't really care. And you don't need to work again. You're extremely rich. You could quit and go buy a winery somewhere, a goat farm, an island. Simplify. Live in peace. What do you want? My mind went blank, scrabbly and darting like a panicked animal. All I could think was that I didn't want to keep feeling the way I felt. I wanted to feel good. An image came to me of myself holding an Oscar aloft, an auditorium of people on their feet, applauding me. I want more, I said. Not less. I want to work. He narrowed his eyes, said in a low growl, good girl. There's no reason you shouldn't have more. Well, I said, there are actually a few. No one in Hollywood cares I was unfaithful to Oliver, but they'll care I was unfaithful to the brand. He groaned extravagantly. You need to get outside this idea of brands. It's so tiresome. Even if this hadn't happened, I would have told you to quit. What's the alternative? You keep doing Archangel until you're too old and they quietly shunt you aside for someone younger? At least now you've established yourself as interesting and unpredictable. Not some comely young automaton. Everyone will be looking to see what you do next. You're not their pawn anymore. And people love a comeback. 3. When I was a teenager wreaking havoc, my Uncle Mitch offered to take me on a trip, just us, anywhere I wanted. He thought it would be good for me to get away. He was between projects anyway. I chose Lake Superior, where my parents' plane had vanished.
Isn't that a little morbid? Mitch said.
I told him I just wanted to see it. And I did. I always had. But I also wanted to go somewhere where we wouldn't do our usual stuff. Some fancy tropical resort wouldn't have been a vacation because we would have just run around getting drunk and finding people to hook up with. Decadence was what I needed a break from. We started in Sault Ste. Marie and drove clockwise all the way around, 1,300 miles in a rented soft-top Jeep Wrangler, the noisy discomfort of which was a just punishment for us being too cool for an economy sedan. I swam every day, even though the water nearly strangled me with cold. I kept thinking about the sunken Cessna out there somewhere, wondering if infinitesimal particles of my parents were floating around me like fireflies. Would they just be bones now? I asked Mitch, shouting over the Jeep's flapping top and Pearl Jam on Canadian radio.
Probably,
he shouted back.
I don't know how long any of that stuff takes.
Why did he learn to fly?
What?
My dad, why did he learn to fly?
I don't know. I never asked.
Why didn't you ask?
I don't know.
He seemed irritated, then softened.
He wasn't someone who liked being asked to explain himself. Runs in the family.
Also, Mitch wasn't great at remembering to be interested in other people. It's not fair to blame him for anything, but the way some parents repeat a mantra to their kids like, treat others how you want to be treated, or actions speak louder than words, Mitch would say,
you only live once.
He would say it when he cracked a beer after 3 months sober, or bet too much on a long shot at Santa Anita. He was the original YOLO guy. When I was little, I made casting agents laugh by solemnly parroting him whenever they asked me if I wanted to show them my biggest smile or be in a commercial for a water park. With my dirtbag Katie McGee era friends, I didn't even bother saying it. They knew. Mitch would never have called himself a parent anyway. On the lake's northern shore, I learned from informational placards that mountains as big or bigger than the Himalayas had once stood there, maybe the highest mountains that ever existed. But they had eroded away to nothing. Time kicking down that particular sandcastle, glaciers scraping the rock bare and then disappearing too. I asked Mitch other questions about my parents, but mostly he didn't know or couldn't come up with anything interesting. One night when we'd stopped at a diner, I said, what if they didn't die? Mitch was smacking the side of a ketchup bottle.
What do you mean?
What if they just went off somewhere and never came back? He put down the ketchup and fixed me with a grave expression. Not easy to pull off under the David Beckham faux hawk he'd had at the time.
Hadley, they wouldn't have done that to you.
Or to you?
They died. That's what happened. You need to believe that.
Yeah, I said. I knew what I needed to believe. But knowing and believing weren't the same. Where I was sitting, there'd once been mountains higher than Everest. Anything was possible.
An incomplete history of Missoula, Montana, circa 13,000 BC to February 1927. 15,000 years ago, an ice sheet advances from the north. A long glacial finger reaches down and plugs the Clark Fork River west of where Missoula will be. A lake forms, grows massive and spidery, 3,000 miles square, 2,000 feet deep, reflects the shadowed undersides of clouds. Mountain tops turn to islands. Icebergs calve into the lake, float and drift. Sometimes boulders are locked inside them, carried south from far away. A journey of hundreds of years, maybe a thousand. When the bergs melt, the rocks plummet to the lake bed. The lake gets too big, too deep, paws and digs at the ice dam until it turns buoyant and cracks apart, releasing the water. Collapsing, the lake churns over what will be Idaho, Oregon, Washington. The whole thing drains in 3 days, emptying at 10 times the combined power of all the rivers in our world. Though no statistic can get at its marauding violence, its diluvianness. Like gleeful strong men, the currents tossed giant rocks and huge chunks of ice into the air. Canyons are dug, herds swept away. Mastodons and mammoths are caught up and drowned and washed into the slack water. Saber-toothed cats, too, and beavers the size of grizzlies and dire wolves and giant ground sloths and all that lost, oversized menagerie. From the north, the glaciers creep back down the mountains until the river is blocked again. Again, the lake fills. Again, the dam breaks. For 2,000 or 3,000 years, the cycle repeats, until something changes and the ice recedes. On the empty lake bed where 5 mountain valleys come together like the twisted limbs of a sea star, where the peaked and porched and turreted Queen Anne house belonging to Wallace Graves will one day stand, grass grows, saplings bend in the wind. At some point, people, hunters with stone tools, walking from Siberia, leaving behind carvings and paintings on the rocks. What do they make of this endlessly unspooling land? Who can imagine a blue sphere suspended in black infinity? Leaves rustle, rivers bend through valleys. More hunters pass through with better tools, subtler languages, myths about a great flood, teepees and sturgeon-nosed canoes, dogs and horses. In 1805, white people make the scene. Lewis and Clark heading west, then back the other way 10 months later, having seen the Pacific. A narrow and wooded canyon, good for ambushes, leads east out of the valley to plains coursing with bison. Hunters coming from the west are attacked there sometimes by plains people, Blackfeet, possessive of the herds, and the bones of the dead are left behind. White people sidle in again. Port de l'Enfer, French trappers call the canyon because of the bones. Hell Gate. In 1855, a treaty is signed between Isaac Stevens, the governor of Washington Territory, and the local tribes, Bitterroot Salish, Pend'Oreille, Kootenai. The document is a fine example of its pernicious genre, full of tricks and mutual incomprehension, implied promises of death and loss. At night, Stevens dreams of scraping shovels and clanking hammers, of seams stitched with timber and iron. The grand metropolis of Hellgate, population 20, becomes the seat of Washington Territory's new Missoula County. Missoula from a Salish word for cold, chilling waters. Before long, there are tents and sod roof cabins, a few rinky-dink farms, a saloon, a post office, thieves strung up by vigilantes. In 1864, Missoula County is made part of the new Montana Territory. A lumber mill and a flour mill are built upstream. And Hellgate turns into a ghost town in a flash. Everyone gone to Missoula Mills. More houses, stores, streets, banks, a newspaper, a fort to protect the good people of Missoula from the Indians, who have not yet been swept away. In August 1877, more than 700 Nez Perce crossed the mountains from Idaho with their horses and livestock and dogs, retreating from the U.S. Army, looking for a place where they will be left alone, a place that no longer exists. They camp on a riverbank, are awakened by soldiers shooting into their teepees. The soldiers try to burn the teepees, have trouble getting the fires going, keep trying. Though most of the band scatters, some children have been hidden inside under blankets and are burned alive. The warriors regroup, attack. The soldiers retreat. In the night, the band moves on toward what will be Yellowstone. They will try to reach Canada, Sitting Bull's camp there, but most won't make it. Most are sent to Fort Leavenworth. In 1883, the bleeding end of the Northern Pacific Railroad arrives in Missoula from the west. It has to be pushed and pulled 60 more miles to meet tracks en route from the Great Lakes. Not the first transcontinental line, but still pretty good. Still pretty epic. Still pretty helpful as far as settling the wilderness. Ulysses S. Grant binds the continent to itself with a golden spike. More men arrive in Missoula. Rough man, lonely man, thirsty man. Want a drink, boys? Want a girl? Try West Front Street. Follow the red light. Madam Mary Glime, fat and fearsome, owns half the place, maybe more. She'll get you a girl from Chicago, a girl from China, a girl from France. Ask for French Emma. She can get you Chinamen, too, if it's workers you need. If your workers want opium, she'll get that. Missoula gets a telephone exchange and electricity, becomes a new official city in a new official state, Montana, born 1889. A farmer in his field scratches his head over the lonely boulder that seems to have fallen from the sky. A train crosses the plains. Wallace Graves, hungry for mountains he's never seen, is heading west from New York. He gets off in Butte, tries Butte for a while, a bronco of a town, a babble town, where men from far-flung places go into the copper mines together, come out, take their wages to the saloon or to the girls of Venus Alley. Fights in the streets every day, every night. Miner versus miner, drunk versus drunk, Irish versus Italian versus Bohunk versus Swede, Union men versus scabs. Wallace paints the jumbled structures of the mines, the gray figures walking with their tin pails, the headframe and machine buildings of the Never Sweat mine and its seven slender smokestacks like cigarillos stuck in the ground. But it is not quite right for Wallace, this city. He boards a westbound train, disembarks in Missoula, stays. In 1911, Wallace goes with most everyone in town to a field near the fort to watch a pilot named Eugene Ely swoop up out of the bowl of mountains in his Curtiss biplane, breaching the ghostly surface of the forgotten ancient lake. Ely buzzes the crowd, dips his wings. A group of Cree have pitched their teepees nearby. They sit on horseback, watching the machine.
What a world,
Wallace Graves remarks to his lady friend, holding his hat to his head as he looks up. A train crosses the plains. Addison Graves looks through the portraits of his children once again, holding them carefully by the corners so as not to smudge. Wallace goes out to fetch his brother for breakfast and finds the cottage empty. Nothing changed inside except the crates pried open. He finds his old paintings, sees they are not as good as he remembered. He chastises his younger self for his florid brushwork, his trite composition. The children are in the main house, back from the dawn ride he doesn't know they'd taken because he does not trouble himself with how they spend their time. They are washed and combed, of their own doing, and sitting upright at Barrett's breakfast table, waiting to meet their father. He's gone, Wallace says without preamble, coming inside. No note or anything. Barrett at the stove says,
What do you mean he is gone? Gone where?
Just gone.
And his things? They are gone?
He didn't have any things.
Wallace remembers the cardboard portfolio. Addison had taken that, at least. Jamie bolts from the table, pounds up the stairs.
Is he coming back?
Marion asks, rigid with seriousness.
I don't know.
Maybe he went for a walk.
To be honest, I think probably not. Are you upset?
She considers.
I thought he'd want to meet us, but it would have been worse if he'd met us and then left.
I don't know about worse.
But he might come back.
He might.
I wouldn't want him to stay if he didn't want to.
I suppose not, says Wallace. Then, with some venom, heaven forbid he should do something he doesn't want to do.
So things will stay the same?
I suppose they will.
That's all right.
You can be sad. You won't offend me.
She looks out the window, says, Where do you think he went?
I don't know.
I think I would be more sad if I knew where he went.
Wallace nods. Better only to wonder what he'd chosen instead of them. I know what you mean.
For some time, some weeks, it seems possible Addison will return. But the leaves turn orange and the night's cold, and he doesn't come back.
Why do you think he didn't stay?
Jamie is sitting on a footstool in Wallace's studio up in the house's turret. With charcoal on scrap paper, the boy is drawing minnows hovering over a rocky river bottom.
Why did he come here at all? I don't know.
Wallace is at his easel, oils pungent on a palette, sketches pinned up around him.
I don't know him very well. We were never close like you and Marion. I think he meant to stay, but he got spooked.
He leans to look at Jamie's drawing.
That's very good. I have a sense of water moving around the fish. It's clever how you did that.
Spooked by what? Wallace's brush nibbles at the canvas.
By you. By the fact of you. It's only a guess, but I think he might not have liked the idea of owing us anything.
Why would he think he owed us? Wallace puts down his brush.
You are a very dear boy.
Why?
It's a forgiving question, that's all.
Quietly, to the charcoal fish, Jamie says,
I don't think I do forgive him, though.
Life proceeds as before. Barrett struggles to keep order. She tries and fails to get Marion to wear dresses. There is never quite enough money. Wallace is paid well by the university, but likes to bet on cards. Sleeping dogs lie strewn through the house. In their bedrooms, where they seldom sleep, preferring the porch, the twins hoard clattery jumbles of antlers and moose paddles and foraged troves of bones and teeth. Crumbling birds' nests line their windowsills in the company of pine cones and interesting rocks. Feathers are pinned to the walls. The twins pick up human artifacts, too. Arrowheads, bits of broken crockery, bullets, nails. Jamie makes drawings of what he finds, arranges still lifes and draws them, adding color with pastels or watercolors Wallace filches for him from the university.
Here come the naturalists, Wallace says when they return to the house in the evenings, extravagantly dirty and with full pockets. Here come the archaeologists, back from the dig.
They do not always go to school. If it is a splendidly sunny day or an enticingly snowy one, they might wander away somewhere else. They have a friend who cuts with them, Caleb, wilder even than they are, a couple of years older, the son of a whore who lives in a sagging old cabin just down the rattlesnake. Gilda, Caleb's mother, had chosen as a surname for herself and her son the name of the river that flows up from the south and joins the Clark Fork on the far side of town, Bitterroot. Caleb is a graceful feline child with long black hair loosed down his back, so straight and glossy that people say his father must have been either an Indian or a Chinese. He picks pockets. He steals moonshine from his mother and sweets and fish hooks from the shops downtown. He hates the men who come to his cabin, hates what his mother does with them, but will brook no insult to her. He'll sock Marion in the gut or arm as soon as he will Jamie. And in summer, all three swim naked in creeks and rivers.
Though Marion and Jamie have both gone at different times to watch through a gap in the curtains when Gilda is at work, they have not discussed what they saw. Jamie was troubled by how much bigger the man was than Gilda. The way he threw his body at hers with the mindless force of a pile driver. Gilda's small feet in their dirty stockings bobbled. Helplessness upsets Jamie. He rescues drowning bees from the creek, brings home stray dogs, feeds abandoned baby birds with an eyedropper. Then, with worms, he gets Marion to chop up. The birds look like angry old men with their wrinkled necks and open mouths. Some live, some die. Wallace offers little resistance to the dogs, the other creatures. "Poor soul," he says, looking over a raven chick too weak to lift its head. "No more," Barrett says after every new addition. But she saves scraps for the dogs. Jamie has a recurring nightmare in which he is made to choose between shooting Marion and shooting a dog. He will not eat meat. "You will die with no meat," Barrett says, and yet Jamie lives on. He'd been reassured when, in the midst of all the ruckus, Gilda had reached up and coolly smoothed her hair back into place. Marion, during her turn at Gilda's window, had been transfixed by how the man, a different man from Jamie's, had become a wild beast. How his face had twisted and his back arched. How he'd shoved Gilda up the bed and gobbled blindly between her legs. Eventually, after he had mounted her the way a dog or elk would, he went still. The beast vanished and he became a man again, a friendly-looking man straightening his clothes. Marion began to study men after that. Shopkeepers, neighbors, Wallace's friends, Wallace, the milkman, the postman, peering too intently into faces, looking for beasts. Wallace knows Marion and Jamie slip off on adventures. He chooses not to go past the vaguest knowing, not to worry they might not return. He has adventures of his own. Sometimes he goes off after dark to find a poker game, a drink in a speakeasy or roadhouse, a woman. He is a quiet drunk, but an ardent one. A check arrives from a bank in Seattle, a decent sum. A letter with it explains that Mr. Addison Graves wishes money to be sent periodically for the upkeep of the children. Wallace goes out and loses most of it right away in a roadhouse card room. A larger check had come once when the children were very small, their settlement from the estate of their maternal grandfather. He'd used it to settle a debt. On his way home at dawn, he stops and immerses himself in the oxbow pond where he'd taken Addison. But the water is cold and tea brown, and he does not feel cleansed, only scummy and sodden. Sullenly, floating, he mulls over whether the money from Addison was newly earned or from some reserve of his savings. He thinks his brother should have known better than to send him so much money at once. But then he remembers Addison knows nothing of his gambling. The cottage that was meant for Addison glows at night like a sturdy, neighborly moon, because Marion has made it her place. After her father's brief visit, she'd unpacked all the crates herself. Such wonders to be sorted through. Wallace's paintings, books of all thicknesses and dimensions, and then the glorious, bewildering array of exotic souvenirs. Some were self-explanatory, rugs, vases, and others were mysterious, such as the 7-foot-long, sharp-ended, spiraled animal horn wrapped in burlap and packed in a long tube all its own. She'd propped the horn in a corner behind the stove, left it leaning there like the neglected staff of a sorcerer. She wishes she could imagine her father buying, say, a particular red and black wooden bowl. But she doesn't know what sort of scene to visualize. A bustling city? A lonely fishing village? A hot place? A cold place? Why had he chosen this bowl of all the bowls in the world?
She'd stacked the books in teetering columns against one wall. She would read them, she decided, one after the other, in the order they were stacked. And she begins to do this shortly after her 10th birthday. Here and there, after she's been working on Wallace's car or mending bicycles for other children, she leaves some streaks of grease on the pages. But she decides her father is the kind of man who wouldn't mind. During the day, she carries a book with her, to school or into the hills. In the evenings, she goes to the cottage and reads in the armchair by the stove. Had her father sat in it even once? Before this windfall of books, she had not been a reader, and is unpracticed at sitting still for so long. The first volume on the first stack, not quite by chance, is Dracula. And like her mother, she has distressing dreams about Renfield, the lunatic who feeds flies to spiders and spiders to birds, and when he can't obtain a cat to eat the birds, eats them himself, alive. She dreams about the beast with Gilda, and in the dream she knows the beast is Renfield, the devourer. There is no one, of course, who can tell her that her mother had also been frightened by the idea of such an appetite. No one had ever known. Among the books are novels and some collections of verse, and quite a few volumes of illustrations of plants and birds and animals labeled in Latin that she tells Jamie he may come and look at, but may not take anywhere. There is a collection of Shakespeare and a fat dictionary that she keeps nearby for words she doesn't know. But mostly, there are accounts of journeys. She reads about storms and wrecks, pirates and armadas, crews forced to eat their comrades. Renfield reappears in her dreams. She reads about Tahitian mountains rising from warm seas, their emerald summits wreathed with cloud, about the forbidding Himalayas and the high pastures of the Alps where cowbells toll. She reads about James Cook and Charles Darwin and Mary Kingsley and Richard Henry Dana and about Lewis and Clark walking through the very same valley where she lives. She reads about the winds in the Strait of Magellan that can push a ship backward at such speeds its prow leaves a wake. Winds that blow Arabian sand hundreds of miles out to sea in choking orange clouds. She reads about the Congo and the Nile and the Yangtze and the Amazon. She reads about wild naked children in hot climates who play games of looking and touching, not unlike those Caleb sometimes devises when Jamie isn't around. She reads about waves towering like mountains, about maddening calms, circling sharks, whales that leap free of the ocean, volcanoes that ooze fire. There are no books among them about little girls like herself, but she does not notice. So her father, besides making journeys of his own, liked to read about those made by others. Presumably, he approved of people who had adventures. She likes Joshua Slocum's account of sailing around in the world alone in his little oyster sloop, the Spray, feeling like a planet unto himself. She would like to feel that way. Her very favorites, though, are the accounts of the far north and the far south, where ship's rigging sags heavy with frost, and blue icebergs drift freely, arched and spired like frozen cathedrals. She reads accounts by Fridtjof Nansen and Roald Amundsen and about the vanished Sir John Franklin, but is not satisfied and brings back more books from the library, gorging herself on the deprivations suffered by Ernest Shackleton and Apsley Cherry Garrard. Bravery at the polls seems appealingly simple. If you go there, or try to, you are brave. She comes across an etching of narwhals crowding a patch of open water amid Arctic pack ice. Tusks clashing in the air like sabers in a battlefield melee. From the corner behind the stove, she retrieves the long horn and goes out across the snowy yard to the main house. Wallace is up in his studio, Beethoven on the phonograph.
He takes the book into his lap and studies the image.
Yes, I see, he says. I think you're right.
A narwhal tusk, Marion says. Here in Missoula, Montana. He looks at the etching again.
Are they fighting?
It says they're breathing. You don't think my father killed the one this came from, do you?
I think he probably bought it.
Why is it? She asks Wallace, leaning on the spiraled tusk, her long, pale braid pulled forward over her shoulder. That both the North and the South are so cold. Why are their seasons flip-flopped? And why is it sometimes always dark and sometimes always light?
I don't know, he says.
He flips through the book, passing images of Eskimos and dog sleds and icebergs and grimacing whales flapping their tails. He wonders if his brother had seen all those things. Marion does not seem like a child to him, nor like an adult. She has an avidity that unnerves him. She goes back out across the snow, toward the cottage suspended in the dark like a lantern hanging from a bowsprit. More than 2 years have passed since her father's brief stay in it. She hopes more of his belongings will be explained by the books, that by the time she has read them all, she will know what he knew. In a way, then she will know him. And later, when she is grown, she will go to the places she has read about, see things for herself. Nights and days, summers and winters. Barnstormers. Missoula, May 1927, 3 months later. The morning was cold, but Fiddler's Barrel warmed Marion's legs. She rode bareback, reins loose, ducking under pine boughs that swept through the early gloom. When Fiddler paused to snatch wisps of grass, she pressed his ribs with her bare heels. Most mornings since last September, when she'd turned 12, she'd risen before dawn and bridled the horse. Jamie seldom came along anymore, maybe because he sensed she preferred to go alone. Depending on her whim, she and Fiddler might follow the banks of the Clark Fork or Bitter Root, or they might wander through town, watching the plodding circuit of the milkman's wagon, the lonely homeward transits of night workers and wandering drunks. If there wasn't too much snow, she might ride up one of the mountains or canyons. This day, she had turned away from the rattlesnake, ascending Mount Jumbo as the last stars winked out and the sky blued and glowed. Fiddler swung into a trot up the steep rise to the summit, where he stopped and immediately began to graze. Low silver fog lay on the valley floor, pierced by roofs and treetops. From behind her, the rising sun's rays played over the ranks of mountains across the valley, tilted slowly down onto Missoula, dispersing the fog until ordinary, tidy daylight glinted off the river. Thrusting her feet forward to hook the reins, she lay back on the horse, hands behind her head on Fiddler's haunches. She was almost dozing when she heard the distant sound of an engine. She took it for one of the local aircraft, rickety surplus Jennies and standards sold cheap after the war and flown mostly by hobbyists. The sound was coming from the east, louder, louder still. She pushed herself up just as a red and black biplane roared over, as abrupt and magnificent as an announcing angel, passing so low it seemed she could have touched the wheels. The Flying Breyfogles. So it said in looping white script on the tails of their Curtis Jennies. They were Felix and Trixie, refugees from Wilton Wolf's Flying Circus, which had gone defunct after the government decided the festive local air shows that had sprung up everywhere after the war involved too many people plunging festively to their deaths and tightened regulations. The Breyfogles were heading west, to Hollywood,
to find stunt work in the pictures. Other barnstormers had come through town before, selling rides and doing aerobatics and parachute jumps. But Marion had never really noticed them, never considered how an airplane could pass over the mountains, over the horizon, carry people elsewhere. Maybe she had needed the dangerous proximity of the plane, its roar and the red flash of its wings to jolt her from obliviousness. Or maybe the moment was simply right. She was at an age when the future adult rattles the child's bones like the bars of a cage. Wallace drove her later that day to the airstrip at the base of Mount Sentinel that was nothing fancier than a reasonably level field marked with lime and pocked with badger holes. He'd barely stopped the car before she bolted like a rambunctious colt, galloping away across the grass toward the parked planes. The cowling doors were open on the nearer plane's engine, and a figure in a mechanic's overall was standing on a stepladder and digging among the valves and cylinders. Another figure, in breeches and boots, lay in the shaded grass under the far plane's wing, face covered by a wide-brimmed cattleman's hat, apparently asleep. The person on the stepladder straightened up and turned, and Marion was surprised to realize it was a woman. A blue bandana covered her hair. Her face was streaked with grease. A spanner dangled from one hand. "Hello," the woman said, looking down at the girl and then back across the field at Wallace. "Who might you be?"
"I'm Marion Graves."
"Did you come to see the planes? Our mighty squadron of two?" Her way of speaking was sing-songy and mannered. She pulled a second bandana from her pocket and wiped her face, further smudging the grease.
"I saw them already. This morning, I was on my horse and one flew right over me."
Fiddler had spooked and she had nearly fallen off. Just as she'd recovered herself, the other plane had passed over, higher but still loud enough to upset Fiddler all over again.
"They do seem quite low sometimes, don't they? But really, we're much higher than you think. Safety first, I always..."
She stopped.
"Oh, you mean up the mountain. That was you, dear heart. You poor thing. You must have been awfully frightened. Felix can be very silly."
"I wasn't scared."
"I'm glad you came by so Felix could apologize in person. I can absolutely promise you it was an accident, just a silly mistake. You're all right, I'm glad to see."
Marion gathered her courage to say what had been consuming her all morning.
"I'd like to go up in one."
The woman tilted her head, screwed up her face in an expression Marion supposed was meant to suggest sympathy.
"I'm afraid we won't be giving any rides until tomorrow, and the fact is, they cost money. $5. We have to pay for fuel and so on, it's how we make a living. I'm sorry Felix frightened you, but we can't start taking up anyone who wants to go, much as we'd like to. Maybe we could give you a small discount as a friendly gesture, but you'll have to ask your father there if he'll pay, unless you've been saving up."
This last quite hopefully. "He's my uncle."
"You'll have to ask your uncle then."
Wallace, arriving, shaded his eyes with one hand and smiled up at the woman.
"What will she have to ask me?"
"This brave young lady wants to go up in a plane."
Again, the bandana swabbed at the grease, this time more effectively, and a long, narrow, greyhound face emerged.
"Can I?"
Marion demanded of Wallace, boisterous from the embarrassment of having to ask. She and Jamie weren't given pocket money in any sort of regular way. It did not seem to occur to Wallace that there might be things they wanted to buy, and so, under Caleb's tutelage, they'd turned to petty thievery, pinching candy and fishing tackle and various bits and bobs from the stores downtown. Caleb, in an hour on a busy street, could unobtrusively dip enough coins from passers-by for 3 movie tickets and lunch at a beanery. When they had any money, they spent it. And so, in what now seemed a terrible oversight, Marion had nothing saved.
How much does it cost?
Wallace asked the woman.
$5 for 15 minutes. $4.50 for you, since we're all friends now. And that's a bargain.
Wallace smiled at Marion. The same appreciative but noncommittal smile he'd directed at the fine blue sky, the grease-smeared stranger. To the woman, he said,
I hope we're not bothering you. Marion had a close encounter with one of your planes this morning. It made an impression.
Poor dear. It must have been so frightening.
It wasn't, Marion insisted. I liked it.
Are you having engine trouble?
Not more than usual.
I know about engines. I take care of Wallace's car, don't I, Wallace?
She does, he told the woman. Marion is a born mechanic.
How charming.
The sleeping figure under the other plane stirred. A sun-browned arm curled up to unhat the face, and a man came out from under the wing, stretched his back. He was trim, compact, densely mustachioed, and crossing the grass had a leisurely, bow-legged stride and an insouciance to the way he set his hat far back on his head with one hand while brushing grass off his seat with the other.
Felix, said the woman. This is the poor little girl you almost mowed down on her horse.
You!
He stopped short with hands on hips.
An unmarked obstacle, you are.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. I could use a reminder not to showboat, if you can call it that when no one's even watching. What were you doing up there so early?
Wallace regarded Marion with interest, as though he'd never considered asking her himself.
I just go up to look around sometimes.
Fair enough.
The man shook hands with Wallace.
Felix Brayfogle. He jerked a thumb at the stepladder. My wife, Trixie. The Flying Brayfogles.
Felix shook Marion's hand next, but didn't let go when she expected. He fixed her with a stern look.
No dead fish allowed. Go on, firm grip. You won't break me.
She squeezed as hard as she could, pumped his wrist.
Better. Cracked a bone or two. You like engines? Want to see this one?
Dear heart, Trixie cut in. I'm afraid I'm busy up here, and we only have the one ladder.
For every problem, there is a solution,
Felix said. He led Marion to the wing, boosted her up onto the varnished canvas.
Hop on my shoulders.
Felix, really? Trixie trilled.
Go on, he said to Marion.
She sat on the wing's edge and scooted onto Felix's shoulders. Not knowing where to put her hands, she clutched the top of his head.
Aren't I too big?
You're a slip of a thing.
He walked her a few steps to the plane's nose.
There, have a good look. Easy on my hair, though. I want to keep it.
What she saw was like a car's engine, but even more wonderful. She studied the paths of fuel and water, noted the valves and rods and bolts, while studiously avoiding Trixie's gaze, baleful across the knot of metal. The glossy wooden propeller blades were elegantly angled to grasp and guide the air.
It's an OX-5,
Felix said from between her knees.
Looks nice, but leaks like a sieve and guzzles oil. Had a good enough look?
Yes, thanks, she said, though she hadn't.
Felix sat her on the wing again, turned to grasp her waist and lift her down.
Say, he said to Wallace, you wouldn't know a place near here that won't cheat us on gasoline, would you?
Marion edged closer to the cowling, reaching up to pet the metal as though it were a horse. And Wallace, watching her, told Felix he would drive him to a good garage if he liked, and then back with the gas. While they were at it, he said, he'd show him a few spots in town to pin up notices advertising their air shows and rides.
And, only a thought, so feel free to decline, But if you're looking for a place to stay, I'd be happy to put you up for the night.
Why, that'd be terrific, said Felix.
And you'd take Marion and her brother for rides tomorrow?
Certainly.
And you, Uncle Wallace, Trixie sang out from above. Don't you want a ride?
To Marion, the presence of the barnstormers transformed their house. On the one hand, she felt newly mortified by its shabbiness because she assumed pilots must be used to the finest things in life. On the other, now that the house contained Felix, it seemed infused with radiant possibility. Did he have a beast in him? Did he grab at Trixie and growl and scowl? She'd clutched his hair in her fingers, felt his shoulders under her thighs. A slip of a thing. Was that what she was? The thought of him made her jumpy, nervy. Already she'd dragged him out to show him Wallace's car, lifted the hood to reveal the patches and fixes she'd contrived in the engine. He was kind to her in a twinkling way and had seemed genuinely impressed by her knowledge of the car. She liked his mustache and his neat waist in belted breeches. While he bathed, she passed by the bathroom more than she needed, pausing once to press her ear against the door, listening for the occasional laconic splash. Naturally, Trixie happened by just then. She was wearing a tired-looking sack-like blue day dress that must have emerged from the tiny valise that was her only luggage. She caught sight of Marion and stopped, her smile wincing and curdled. Her hair, free of its bandana and damp from her bath, was bobbed in a style that was fashionable but did not suit her long face. She wore a dark red lipstick, almost purple, and had lined her eyes and penciled her eyebrows. None of it suited her. She was spoiled by being taken out of her mechanic's garb.
If I didn't know better, I'd think you were snooping, Trixie said.
I wasn't sure if anyone was in there.
The eyebrows lifted. The purple mouth contracted.
Curiosity killed the cat.
Neither could have explained the hostility between them. Marion endured its prickly onslaught without flinching, standing with her back against the bathroom door. A faint splash, a low cough, until Trixie flicked her bob and went on her way. Except for Jamie, who ate a baked potato, they had Barrett's venison stew for dinner.
You don't like stew? Trixie asked Jamie.
He doesn't eat meat, said Marion.
He don't have teeth neither, said Caleb,
who'd shown up unannounced and uninvited as he often did.
There's just gums in there.
It's why he only eats potatoes. He gums them up.
Caleb's mother often spent all her money on drink, and when he wasn't in the mood to fend for himself, he appeared at the Graves table. Barrett clucked over him, fed him sugar cubes, peeled fruit, spoonfuls of jam. She stroked his long hair when she thought no one was looking, its obsidian gloss calling to something unexpected in her orderly Scandinavian soul.
Doesn't have teeth, Wallace corrected.
His one unexpected strictness was about correct language.
He doesn't? Trixie asked.
Jamie has perfectly good teeth, Wallace said. Caleb has an odd sense of humor.
Trixie cast a dirty look at Caleb and turned back to Jamie.
No meat? Why not?
Jamie said, it doesn't agree with me. He means it doesn't agree with him spiritually, Wallace said. Killing animals for food.
Why does everyone speak for the dear boy? He seems to have a tongue as well as teeth.
To Jamie, she said,
what a dear you are. What a gentle lamb.
Jamie, mortified, kept his eyes on his potato. Caleb laughed. Wallace said he'd heard on the radio that the young pilot, Charles Lindbergh, had left New York in the morning and had been spotted passing over Newfoundland in the afternoon, attempting to be the first to fly the Atlantic.
He's over the ocean somewhere now, they say.
Over it, if he's lucky, said Trixie. In it, if he's not.
She smirked as though she'd made a witticism.
If he were older, Felix said, I'd say he was suicidal. But he's a kid, so he's just damn foolish. I'd put his odds at 1,000 to 1.
Marion tried and failed to imagine the sea. She thought of the blue in the atlas, the stories in her father's books. But its immensity eluded her. The dining room had flocked wallpaper and an oblong table with mismatched chairs. A glass front cabinet of the kind that would usually display silver or crystal instead held overflow from Marion and Jamie's collections of rocks and bones. From a plain pint bottle, Wallace poured out something amber for Felix and Trixie, moonshine tinted with brown sugar, though if they wanted to think it was whiskey, they were free to.
How'd you learn to fly?
Marion asked Felix, whose hair was still damp from his bath. He was wearing two big clothes that belonged to Wallace, because his had been washed by Barrett and hung out on the line along with Trixie's.
In France, he said. In the war. I wanted to fly, and the French were willing to take American volunteers and train them.
I'd want to see a war, Caleb said.
Felix looked at Caleb, and a distance passed through him, as though he were sliding back away from the table, receding to somewhere else.
Felix doesn't like to talk about the war, Trixie said.
Felix seemed to snap back into focus.
I'll decide what I talk about, thanks.
He'd been trained in the South, he said, near the city of Poe. When he was ready, he was sent to join a squadron of other Americans at Luxeuil, where they were put up in a villa near a spa. When the weather was bad, they soaked in the hot baths or played cards and drank. When the skies were clear, they went buzzing off to do reconnaissance or go after observation balloons, great gray hydrogen behemoths bobbing over the front.
The best way to bust them was to fly up close and shoot an incendiary round from your pistol, he said. But they were likely to take you with them when they blew up.
He'd seen men blown to bits, shot to pieces, hung up in barbed wire with rats eating them. Wounded men crawling. Where did they think they were going? They were trying to drag themselves away from the pain. Men could die in more ways than he'd thought. Once, a riderless horse had run into the hangar at their aerodrome from God knows where, dreadfully burned, perhaps mistaking the structure for a barn. They'd shot the poor thing to put it out of its misery.
One time, Felix said, I was shooting at a German and his engine caught fire. So he climbed out onto the wing and jumped.
He was wearing a huge brown fur coat and looked like a bear falling through the sky. He had no parachute. He'd decided he'd rather fall than burn.
I might have done the same. His plane flew on for a bit without him, burning, then broke apart.
Unobtrusively, Wallace refilled Felix's glass.
Still, Felix said, raising it, I'd take all that over what Lindbergh's gotten himself into.
The Breyfogles chose the cottage and its single bed over the sleeping porch. After dinner, Caleb went off into the night and Jamie and Marion were sent upstairs to make themselves scarce. They knelt together on Marion's bed, a russet-colored coonhound asleep at the foot, and watched out the window as Felix sat on Fiddler's fence and smoked in the twilight. When the gelding strolled over, the man extended a hand, stroked the old horse's cheek.
Imagine having an airplane and being able to go wherever you want, she said.
Why did he have to tell us about that burned horse? Jamie said.
Usually, Jamie's presence gave Marion a sense of symmetry and rightness, of having been properly balanced. Without him, she was like a too-light canoe at the mercy of the current. He was the calmer one, less impulsive, ballast. He was not exactly part of her, but he was not entirely other either, not like Wallace or Caleb or Barrett or anyone else. But in this moment, she wished him impatiently away. She didn't want to think about the burned horse, only about Felix. There's nothing you can do for it now. Don't think about it. Do you know, he said with vehemence, that sometimes I wish people didn't exist? I really do. People died too, Marion said. She stroked the sleeping dog, who stirred and uncurled onto her side, lifting a leg to show her belly. Millions of them, wasn't it? But the horses didn't understand what any of it was for. For Jamie, there was little solace in watching his own horse stand outside in the pleasant evening, leading a comfortable life, because he could imagine all too clearly Fiddler's panic and confusion if he were to be set on fire, if he ran from the pain but could not escape it. Marion, still gazing at Felix, said, I wonder why he married her, though. She's not very nice. I don't care, Jamie said. We'll never see them again. The world out the window, the tidy barn and cottage, the opalescent sky, struck Jamie as an illusion, a perfidious veil beneath which roiled suffering and death. That Marion did not see as he saw, that she only rested her chin on her fist on the sill and stared moonily down at a stranger and dreamed of flying away from their house where they were safe together, made him feel terribly alone. He said goodnight and went to his room, the coonhound following. The dog jumped up onto his bed, circled and settled. Everything in the shape of the animal commanded love. Her long soft ears, the black hairs mingled with the red on her flanks. The way she slung the tip of her tail cozily over her nose. He could not make peace with the magnitude of suffering in the world. It registered in him as a wave of heat and tingling, an acceleration in his heart and a lightness in his head, a sensation both puny and unbearable. The only way to live was to shut it out. But even when he turned his thoughts away, he was still aware of it. As one who lives alongside a levee is aware of the deluge waiting on the other side. To soothe himself, he took his sketchbook from under his pillow, sat cross-legged, and began to draw the dog. Marion lay down in bed but wasn't ready to sleep. She thought of Felix, turned over her collection of memories from the day. His tan forearms and calloused hands, his soapy smell after his bath, his shoulders under her thighs. There was a pressure between her legs. She ground the heel of her hand there, was startled by the way a ball of sparks burst loose inside her like a blown dandelion puff. Faint voices downstairs. She slid out from under the covers, eased around the door, monkeyed down along the banister to avoid the squeaky spots in the stairs. Wallace and Trixie were sitting on the porch, beyond the yellow splash of light from the kitchen. Marion crouched near an open window.
Where'd all the stuff in that cottage come from? Trixie was asking. Felix was quite intrigued.
Those were my brother's things, Wallace said.
Should I conclude he was some kind of explorer?
In a way.
Is he dead?
I don't know. I don't think so. Marion likes to go out there to read.
She's sweet on Felix, Trixie said. Dear thing. It's cute, really. Although I'm afraid she thinks we're rivals.
It's that she doesn't have a mother. She doesn't know how to be around women.
Women love Felix. Your girl isn't the exception.
I get weary trying to fight them off.
He seems devoted enough. Not that I know anything about it.
He is, I suppose. Enough. The rasp of a match. A whiff of smoke. Say, it must have been strange to have kids dumped on you out of the blue. How long have you had them?
Since they were babies.
You're good for taking them.
No, dutiful. If I were good, I would have... I don't know. I don't know what I would have done. Paid more attention. Been better.
I'd have left them on the church steps, in a reed basket like Moses.
Ah, said Wallace. I think Moses was left in a basket among the reeds.
Either way, I would have found some reeds. Marion's skin prickled as though with sunburn. She went stealthily back up the stairs, heaping recriminations on herself for never before having considered